Zukowski's eyes flicked to the monitor, where the black General Galaxy prototype was engaged in a furious dogfight with Seraph Blue, while the YF-19 jockeyed for firing position on either one. If that's true, then the way Gull's pushing the system to the limit right now means the system is pushing his mind to the limit in return, Callie replied, nodding. How sure are you of this? Terror asked seriously. As sure as I'm standing here, Callie replied flatly. Indicating her laptop, she added, My evidence will stand up in a court-martial if need be. Terror and Dot-Z looked at each other for a moment. Then Zukowski sighed, muttering, It's just one fucking thing after another with this trial, and punched a key on the Situation Room's table comset. This is General Zukowski, she announced. Abort the test. I repeat, abort the test. All test aircraft, return to... Before she could finish the command, a siren sounded. The voice of the Zukowski field comm operator rang over the PA system.
Attention. Attention. Zukowski ATC is under attack. This is not a drill. Repeat, this is not a drill. All pilots designated for base defense report to your aircraft. Test aircraft, return to the field immediately.
Dot-Z stared at the overhead speaker for a moment, then hit another key. This is Zukowski, she said. Who the hell's attacking us? Waiting on positive ID now, General, Lieutenant Ohlendorfer replied. Hostiles are deorbiting from a mothership that just defolded in high orbit. Configuration looks similar to a Cylon base star, but if it is, it's a new model. Damn, Dot-Z snapped. They must be after the prototypes. How many small craft inbound? Not sure yet, Ohlendorfer replied. Preliminary scans indicate maybe 100, maybe more. ETA approximately 10 minutes. I'm going to go fire up my Valkyrie, Terror said. I'll be more help in the air. Good. Go. I'll see if I can interest some of the exhibitors in helping to protect the field. Max Sterling's face appeared on one of the Situation Center's subscreens.
Stonewall Belcom's chase aircraft are available for field defense, General, he announced.
I'll take you up on that, General, Dot-Z told him.
What about the prototypes?
We need to get the YF-21 on the ground now, Callie urged. Zukowski nodded. The Cylons are after all three, most likely. We should put them all under security lockdown, and send MPs to arrest everyone in the General Galaxy hangar. I don't know exactly who's responsible for their part of the mess, but whoever it is will sit out this fight in the brig. We'll figure it out afterwards. That was the plan, anyway. But as the poet said, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang aft aglay, and this was no exception. By the time the three test aircraft reached the field, three things were very clear to everyone watching on the ground. 1. The attackers were, in fact, Cylon fighters, of both the types Kozue had previously seen in the attack on the Galactica. 2. There were a lot more of them than the Field Defense Force could handle on their own. And 3. Sidelining what were arguably the field's top three fighters would be silly. No one really made a conscious decision to defy General Zukowski, and she didn't officially rescind her order, but all the same, the prototypes did not go into security lockdown, and the General Galaxy crew didn't get arrested until after they finished refitting the YF-21 for combat. Joe Frampton and his team swarmed around Seraph Blue, pulling pins and dismounting paint missiles with a speed and deftness that would have impressed Kozue very much if she hadn't been in such a hurry. Opening her canopy and leaning out over the side, she yelled to Frampton, "Get that game software the hell out of my aircraft, Chief!" Frampton gave one of the hurrying armorers a supportive slap on the shoulder, turned, opened up the computer access panel on the underside of the nose, reached in, and yanked the isochip containing the damage sim patch out of the battle computer. "It's dumped," he hollered, slamming the panel. New gun pod will be in place in 20 seconds. Good deal, Kozue replied. Wish we had time to put on the fast packs, she thought, but she didn't say it out loud. They didn't, and pointing it out would only frustrate Frampton more. As the armorers worked furiously, she watched the VF-2's taxi past, already missiled up and ready to go. With a thrill of half-surprise, she saw that Max Sterling was piloting the lead one, his blue Valkyrie helmet unmistakable. The other two had pilots she didn't recognize aboard, and then they were joined by a fourth aircraft, a brilliant scarlet VF-1J, piloted by a woman with a matching helmet and flight suit, a tassel of deep green hair draped down one side of her neck. That must be Myria, Kozue thought absently, feeling momentarily detached from the frantic reality all around her. Damn, she's gorgeous. No wonder he's not shopping. She was jolted from her reverie, and this unworthy thought, as Frampton came halfway up the boarding ladder, chinned himself on the cockpit combing, and said, "You're all set, Lieutenant. Good hunting." "Thanks, Chief," Kozue replied, instantly back to business. Frampton dropped away and smacked the ladder up into place, and the techs scattered as Kozue opened the throttles and guided Seraph Blue back out of the hangar. The sky overhead was full of arching contrails, swarms of missiles, fireballs, puffs of black smoke. Kozue ignored the runway, pointed the Valkyrie at the nearest open stretch of desert, and opened the throttles. Seraph Blue sprang from the ground as if eager to get in on the fight. "The prototypes are joining the fight, General," Ohlendorfer reported. Then, after a slight pause, he added, "All three of them." Zukowski chewed at her thumbnail for a moment, then nodded. "Very well." Callie blinked. "General, we have to get Gull down," she said. "Every second he uses that system in battle." "Gull Bowman wouldn't fly an aircraft he didn't understand," Zukowski told her. "He must know how that system works, which means he's accepted the risk. Normally, I'd override him, but right now this base needs every capable pilot in the air. And like him or not, Gull is one of the most capable pilots we have." "But he's a big boy. He knew the risks when he signed up," the general said. "If he survives this fight, he'll never fly that prototype again. But if he doesn't have a field to come back to, it won't matter anyway." The aerial forces that rose to defend Zukowski FTC were a mixed bag, but that worked to their advantage. The Cylons, with their mission plan set well in advance and overseen by their machine minds, were a bit taken aback to find themselves opposed by such an ill-assorted collection of small craft. Besides the three prototypes and Stonewell Belcom's small force of Block 2 VF-2s, the Cylon attackers found themselves confronted with two earlier model VF-1s, a squadron of VF-11s, and, well, Cylon intelligences weren't much for keeping up with periodicals, but if they were, they might have likened it to a live demonstration of the last year's worth of Aviation Week and Space Technology's Fighters in Development feature. For the pilots of the three Veritek prototypes weren't the only test pilots on the base to strap on their experimental gear and take to the skies. The Wedge Defense Force 17th Technical Test Squadron's pilots were all combat-experienced, highly trained professionals accustomed to flying the hottest, and sometimes the most unpredictable, machinery around, and they were for damn sure not going to just sit around in a bunker and watch this fight on TV. And neither was General Wilhuff Tarkin, of the Genom military arm. So it was that, as she streaked at full burner toward a stratospheric intercept, Kozue saw all manner of strange and unfamiliar icons blink onto her tactical display. The sky was just beginning to take on the deep, New Jeans blue of the tropopause, as three unexpected craft pulled into formation with her and the other two VT prototypes. One was that new Jedi fighter Starbuck had been so interested in on day one, not with the Jedi at the controls, but Tarkin, sublimely indifferent to his earlier claim that the ship required a superhuman pilot to be effective. Another was an SF-8Z Super Crusader, one of the WDF's red-hot, retro-styled fixed-config starfighters. Kozue could see by the stubby pair of finlets below its horizontal tail that it was one of, perhaps the only one of, the upcoming Double Zulu improved models. The third was another retro job, but one she had never seen in person before, one of New Avalon Aerospace's new F-86 Cosmo Sabres, which were still in acceptance testing.
"You guys weren't going to hog the first engagement without us, were you?"
asked an unfamiliar voice on the tactical band.
"Hot Dog Cooper, I will be goddamned. When did you get here?" "Been here all along, rodeo clown,"
the first voice declared.
"I just didn't want to cramp your style."
And Kozue realized, with a thrill, that the speaker could be none other than Leroy G. Cooper, Mercury astronaut, WDF Project Hero participant, and one of her personal idols since she'd started studying the history of aviation.
"Now I know they'd never get you to fly that Navy retread,"
Dyson remarked.
"So who's in the Double Zulu?" "Aw, you know old Highball,"
Cooper replied.
"He'd fly a simulator into combat if he could get it to take off."
They didn't have time for banter after that. The Cylons saw to that. The battle that ensued was essentially two battles. While the 17th and the experimental Veritex labored to keep the Cylons' fighters from achieving air superiority over Zukowski Field so that they wouldn't be able to launch a surface assault force, the Battlestar Aurora and her fighter wings took the fight to the Cylon base star. Kozue would have liked to keep at least one ear tuned to the Colonial Comm Band to monitor how her squadron fared, but she was far too busy with the business at hand. For the moment, she had to forget that she was officially a member of Viper Squadron VX-1 and devote her full attention to the job of flying Seraph Blue like she'd never flown any fighter before. Many things were established in the next half hour. Principal among them was the fact that all three of the Veritech prototypes were damned fine aerospacecraft. From the edge of space right down to the deck and most of the way back up again, the pilots of the YF-19, YF-21, and VF-1S-82 pulled out all the stops and showed the Cylons that they had picked the wrong flight test to interrupt. All three were spectacular performers, and between them they spearheaded a counterattack that devastated the Cylon raiders. But there were those, like Max and Mary Sterling and the pilots of the 17th, in a position to notice that one was emerging as the first among equals. In between the Sturmvogel's eerie, near-silent, almost unnatural precision and the Excalibur's astonishing speed and agility, the Mark 82 Valkyrie displayed the perfect balance of maneuverability, versatility, survivability, and firepower that had made the VF-1 the galaxy's finest Veritech fighter since the invention of the concept. In Kozue Kaworu's hands, Seraph Blue made it plain to anyone who had the mental bandwidth to notice that all other full-sized Veritech aerospace superiority fighters, including these two latest contenders, were still just chasing the Valkyrie. Stonewell Belcom's engineers had raised the bar yet again, and now the borrowed Colonial pilot was ably demonstrating just how high it was. Kozue had no idea she was putting on a clinic, of course. She was far too busy staying alive and making sure the bad guys didn't. That was, Jolly had stressed during training, something like the Colonial Warrior's main job when he got right down to it. Hugely outnumbered, she applied a trick she had learned from Jackie Chan, her pal in the Experts of Justice, and didn't think about how many there were. She kept her mind loose, taking on targets as they presented the best opportunity, and not getting hopelessly locked on any single one, but, and this was the important part, she only paid full attention to one of them at a time. She kept track of the myriad factors a working fighter pilot had to contend with, engine status, weapon temperatures, ammunition levels, all the while calculating firing arcs, managing energy, staying ahead of the aircraft and the enemy. Never be quite where they expect you. Always keep a little something in reserve. Stay on target, but don't get tunnel vision. And always, always keep moving. And then, the sky was empty.
"All craft, this is Zukowski Control,"
came the broadcast from below.
"Airspace is secure. The surviving Cylons are bugging out. Good work, everybody. All craft return to base.
A moment later, General Zukowski's own voice came over the air.
Priority landing clearance to the YF-21. Major Bowman, I want that prototype on the ground now. Acknowledge.
Silence. Cosway's palms itched. Gold was a jerk, but he was, above everything else, a professional jerk. Ignoring a direct order from a superior officer wasn't his style. But there was the YF-21, maybe 1,000 feet above her and 1.5 miles ahead, not turning for home and not acknowledging Zukowski's transmission, and sliding rather ominously into position behind Isamu Dyson's YF-19. "Rodeo, check 6!" Cosway cried.
"What?"
Dyson replied.
"What the... Gold, what the hell are you doing?"
A pair of air-to-air missiles made it abundantly clear what the hell Gold was doing, and Dyson, caught utterly flat-footed at point-blank range, had no chance to evade them. The Excalibur's last act was to prove how well it was built by not just blowing into 1,000,000 pieces and taking Isamu Dyson with it. Instead, though rather more than 50% of it blossomed instantly into a comet tail of fire and smoke, its cockpit module remained intact long enough for the shocked pilot to be catapulted to safety by his fighter's automatic ejection system. Several overlapping streams of startled chatter erupted on the comm, but Cosway tuned them all out. She had neither the time nor the inclination to listen to everyone else in the vicinity of Zukowski Field reacting to Gold's sudden, senseless act of fratricide, because the YF-21 was turning toward her with the unmistakable implication that she was next. Cosway glanced at her radar. The fight had carried the 3 Veritechs far from the field, out over the gunnery test range. The Sterlings and the 17th had already turned for home. They might be able to get a piece of this action, but not right away. For the time being, she was on her own. Out of the blue, and for no reason she could discern, her long-anticipated showdown with Gold Goa Bowman had become 100% for real. Okay, if that was the way he wanted to play it. The YF-21 Sturmvogel was faster than any Valkyrie, even Seraph Blue. It reacted with the speed of thought. At the end of a long fight in which its computer-assisted combat systems had practiced machine-precise weapon economy, it had more ammunition left in the shop, and its shadow system rendered it impossible for Seraph Blue's targeting system to get a positive lock. On paper, even the more versatile advanced VF-1 prototype shouldn't have been a match for it in a straight-up head-to-head dogfight. On the other hand, on paper, Seraph Blue didn't have Cosway Kaworu flying it. Almost immediately she abandoned the use of her instruments, except the Valkyrie's all-aspect camera, and relied on the Mark I eyeball and her razor-sharp personal edge to keep her ahead of the YF-21's efforts to kill her. For all that he had his brain plugged directly into his fighter's control systems, Gold still flew predictably. He had ways he liked to do things, ways so ingrained that they were printed in his very neural pathways. He might be flying by direct thought control, but he still wasn't flying on instinct, because Gold didn't fly that way. Cosway didn't fly any other way, which was why, as Max Sterling had so discerningly pointed out, Gold had been against her from the moment he became responsible for her training. It wasn't even jealousy, per se. It ran deeper than that. It was more like Gold regarded her talent and her reliance on it as a form of cheating. It offended his sensibilities on some entirely unconscious level. Unconscious, but subject to the effects of the YF-21's flawed neural controls all the same.
Cosway, this is Kelly. Come in.
Little busy right now.
This is important.
Callie's voice came back, clipped and cool as she almost never was when speaking in person.
The YF-21's cybernetic control system is multitronic. Repeat, multitronic. Acknowledge.
Cosway's eyes widened behind her tinted visor, and her acknowledgement took the somewhat non-standard form of a blurted, "Oh, Sprock." Multitronic. What maniac thought that was a good idea? She'd read Griffin's memoir, the one about the last 50 years of his original WDF career that he'd only been able to write after his exile. She knew about the X-9 Ghost incident, an AI-controlled experimental fighter based on cyberneticist Richard Daystrom's multitronic principle, had shot up the Prometheus and killed several WDF fighter pilots before Griffin and the other 8-Balls managed to destroy it. It turned out Daystrom was mentally ill, and the multitronic systems, based on his neural patterns, had carried the flaw along. She didn't need Callie to spell out the rest of her deductions. In a moment of brain-racing clarity, it all snapped into place. The question was what to do about it. She had absolutely zero problem at all with the idea of blowing Guld away if he was seriously trying to kill her. But if he'd been driven to it by a defect in his neural control system, that was a different story. She'd probably still be justified, still walk away from the inevitable court-martial. After all, the man was at the controls of a fighter that was shooting at her. But she'd never feel right about it. Not after the history they had. A burst of cannon fire flashed past Seraph Blue's starboard vertical stabilizer. Kozue kicked left rudder without thinking about it, then snapped into a split S and foiled Guld's next attempt at a gunnery pass with an unexpected, and painful, rollout before reaching the logical end of the maneuver. In most Valkyries, she'd probably have lost her empennage trying that stunt, but she didn't even consider that. She had developed that much of an instinctive rapport with the machine during the battle against the Cylons, and besides, she was busy making a decision. She reached to the comm panel, flicked it to another band, and said, "Hey, Guld, listen up." She heard nothing in reply but the sound of labored but steady and measured breathing, like someone doing strenuous yoga. "Here's something for you to think about," Kozue went on, confounding a missile with another trip to the ragged edge of Seraph Blue's performance envelope and a couple of flares. "Say you do kill me. Then what?"
"What the hell are you doing, Kaworu?"
Someone, one of the 17th pilots, she thought, maybe Highball Jordan, said in her other ear. She ignored him and continued, "I mean, do you seriously think anyone's going to believe that you were the better pilot?" No response, but Guld's harsh breathing accelerated. Kozue smirked, knowing it would get into her voice, and went on, "Your bird's fully instrumented for flight test, bud. It's gonna be obvious you were just letting the computer do the work." Guld's reply was a guttural sound somewhere between a grunt and a moan, combining fury and a sort of dismay. The YF-21 almost seemed to hesitate, the morphic panels on its wings flexing fitfully. Then it recovered, throttling up, and caught the inner axis of Seraph Blue's turn. This was the first fully unexpected thing Guld had done so far, and under the circumstances, Kozue took it as a paradoxically good sign, even if it did lead to a most inconvenient moment. She avoided taking a direct missile hit by a lightning switch to Gerwak mode and a full-on thrust reversal, but the proximity warhead detonated within 100 yards. Seraph Blue's deflector charge was still fairly strong, and the shields were well able to prevent shrapnel damage, but the portside engine ingested the fireball gases. This did no particular harm, but it did cause the turbine to stall. "Crap," Kozue muttered as the Valkyrie began to fall. Guld was still making that gritted teeth noise as the YF-21 nosed over to pursue. Kozue thumbed the restart button, got a warning light in response. The engine's RPM hadn't coasted down far enough for a relight to be safe. She made a mental note to mention that to the engineers. Bit of a liability in a situation like this. "I mean, sure, if that's how you want to go down in history," she said. "More power to you, I guess. But it's cheap. And anybody in our world, anybody who matters, they're gonna know that." Guld replied. The YF-21's exhausts flared blue as the ship went into full burner to pursue her toward the deck, and then the black fighter abruptly pulled out of the dive and disengaged. Kozue got a relight, felt Seraph Blue immediately return to full controllability, spread her wings to minimum sweep, and recovered with 10,000 feet to spare. The YF-21 was a mile or so above, circling back to the south, as if Guld couldn't quite decide where he was heading.
Omega-1,
Guld said, sounding weary and strained.
Request return vec error.
An electronic voice interrupted him.
Operator signal lost. Mission incomplete. Switching to automatic. What? Override.
Guld snapped.
Operator off.
His cry of pain was cut off by a burst of static before the channel went dead. A moment later, Kozue saw the Sturmvogel's opaque canopy fragment as embedded charges fired, clearing it out of the way for the ejection seat. This followed a moment later, blasting Guld clear, and the YF-21, its empty cockpit trailing wisps of smoke, turned back toward Kozue. Okay, that I did not expect, she mused. Without the programmed constraints the YF-21 had to observe in order to keep from killing its soft, squishy organic pilot, the prototype was even faster, its reactions even more unnaturally violent but precise. Its rudimentary automatic intelligence seethed with a weird synthetic duplicate of Guld Bowman's psychological issues, refracted through a warped digital analog of Richard Daystrom's paranoid sociopathic tendencies. Inasmuch as it could know anything, apart from purely telemetric matters like course, speed, and weapons status, it knew only that it wanted the pilot of the Blue VF-1 dead. The advanced aerospacecraft's every circuit and servo was dedicated to that one overriding purpose, and without Guld aboard it had nothing at all to moderate it. Kozue barely avoided another spread of missiles. How many did the goddamn thing carry, anyway? And gritted her teeth as Seraph Blue's shields shed most, but not all, of a cannon burst. Pockmarks appeared in the port wing. Nothing critical, but the beginning of a trend she couldn't afford to let continue. Professional pride or not, she had to admit, as Griffin had against the X-9, that without a pilot on board, this thing could easily edge her in the sheer violence of the maneuvers it could perform. If she just tried to outfly it, as she had against Guld, she would lose and she would die. Think, Kozue, she told herself, nearly redding out as she drove her protesting Valkyrie through a -G pushover that barely got her canopy out of the YF-21's cannon sights in time. What have you got that this thing hasn't? It's faster than you, it's got more ammo, it probably knows every maneuver every pilot has ever bothered to program into a simulator or holotape. It doesn't feel pain or fear, and it's never going to quit. Let's test that, shall we? Faking to port, Kozue gave the YF-21 a missile to evade, one of her last two, and then pointed Seraph Blue's nose skyward and opened the throttles all the way. The Mark 82 was the first Valkyrie capable of escaping from standard gravity with only the thrust of its main engines. Prior models had needed a set of dorsal boosters, the most visually distinctive feature of the so-called Super Valkyrie pack, or a special single-stage-to-orbit rocket sled to accomplish this feat. Of course, the Sturmvogel could do this too. It was one of the basic requirements of the next-generation Veritech specification all three of these prototypes had been built to compete under. Even with the head start her missile attack had given her, there was no way Kozue could outrun the YF-21 in space either, nor were her prospects for outfighting it any better in vacuum. That was all right, though. She wasn't planning to try and fight it in vacuum.
Hang on, Bunky, we're a-comin',
Starbuck's voice declared on the Rogue Squadron band. Kozue checked her scope. They were indeed. The full complement of the squadron, less herself, appeared to be making for an orbital rendezvous at best speed, with the Aurora herself chugging in at full throttle behind them. They weren't going to arrive in anything like enough time, though, even with their Vipers firewalled. That was fine, too, if the YF-21 played its part. A shuddering crash from somewhere aft made it plain that it was. Kozue flicked her ship to port, then starboard, maneuvering at random to try, as best she could, to evade the YF-21's fire as it chased her into the stratosphere. The sky turned indigo, sliding toward black, the stars beginning to wink into view. Off to starboard, an unhelpful distance away, she could see the light of Muroc flashing from the Aurora's armor, the Vipers of Rogue Squadron far too small to see at this distance. Her warning system wailed at her as the YF-21 achieved missile lock. Her HUD altimeter went blank. They were above Muroc 3's Karman line. Time for Phase 2. Kozue winged over and dove for home. Seraph Blue and the YF-21 flashed past each other almost belly-to-belly, avoiding a collision by inches at speeds that would have been hypersonic if they hadn't technically been in space. The sudden target convergence completely flummoxed the Sturmvogel's missile lock. Without an instant's hesitation, the black fighter reversed course as well, and followed the VF-1 back into the atmosphere. This was, Kozue knew, a dicey maneuver without full deflectors. According to the specs she had absorbed before the test began, Seraph Blue's armor should be able to withstand the heat and shock of atmospheric entry by itself. But the docs recommended at least 50% shielding as a safety margin. She had, glance at relevant indicator, 34%, and some armor damage to her port wing and starboard rudder vader. Things might get a bit warm before she was through the ionization layer. On the other hand, she wasn't hurtling through the friction zone with no cockpit canopy. Telemetry for Seraph Blue and the YF-21 flatlined at almost the same moment. Moments later, and for the second time in a week, Callie Henderson rode a borrowed Cyclone across the Muroc 3 desert with one of Zukowski Field's recovery hover trucks in pursuit and a column of black smoke rising on the horizon. "Please don't be dead," she thought, hunching lower over the handlebars and urging more speed from her Cyclone. Miria Sterling's red Valkyrie streaked past overhead, in formation with one of the Belcom VF-2s. They disappeared over the horizon, then reappeared a few moments later and headed back toward them at a more leisurely pace.
"Recovery, this is Victory 1,"
came Max Sterling's laid-back voice.
"Follow me."
They followed, and what they saw a half-hour later made Callie sit up straighter on her Cyclone and laugh with relief. A mile or so distant, Seraph Blue lay on the desert floor, listing slightly to starboard, and resting at a slight nose-up angle, with the frozen bow wave of upturned earth under her pointed prow, but substantially intact, apart from the sheared-off stub of her starboard tail fin and some visible warping of her port wing. The canopy stood open. Much nearer, Kozue Kaworu walked toward them, her helmet under her arm, a panel of bright orange parachute sin-silk arranged on her head in a sort of improvised keffiyeh. Alongside her, his arm over her shoulders for support and the metal struts of an improvised lower leg splint glinting in the sun, limped Guld Bowman. Barely visible on the far horizon, what remained of the YF-21 boiled angrily into the clear blue sky. Kozue looked up as Callie pulled to a halt, the hover truck grounding behind her. "About time you guys showed up," she said with a grin. "Okay, okay, settle down! Hey!" General Zukowski busted out another of those ear-splitting whistles, the only weapon in her arsenal that could possibly cut through the tumult of this evening at Pancho's. "Thank you," she said dryly as everyone turned to face the stage. "Got a couple of quick announcements to make, and then we can all get back to business. First, the contest. After much deliberation, Terror and I decided to go with the Dash 82, on account of it was the only one to survive the fly-off." That drew a roughly even mix of applause and catcalls. "Second, we've cut a deal with General Galaxy where they don't bill us for their prototype and we don't throw them all in Tacron Galtos for using multitronic technology." More catcalls than cheers greeted that one. "And finally, as a personal thank you for saving what is, after all, my very own airbase, got my name on it and everything, tonight the drinks are on me." That, on the other hand, got 100% cheers. Somebody plugged the jukebox back in, Jerry Lee resumed pounding his piano, and the party resumed as if the official business had never intruded. So Redback says to the MP, "Well, how do you think my pants got this way in the first place?" Starbuck finished, and the pilots of the 17th laughed as if the joke hadn't been interrupted. Life of the party. Boomer observed her wingmate as Gordo Cooper picked up the War Story token and started in on a tale from the mythic days of Project Mercury that involved Wally Schirra and urine samples. "You know it," Starbuck replied. "Just so you're warned in advance, I am totally bagging Jordan tonight." Boomer snorted. "You're right." "Okay, don't believe me. I know the signs," Starbuck assured her sagely. Then she looked around. "Grife, what's keeping Kaworu? This is supposed to be her party." Boomer shrugged. "Hell if I know. Maybe she managed to get thrown in the stockade before she even got here." As it happened, Kozue was in the stockade, but not as a guest. "What are you doing here, Kaworu?" Galt Bowman asked from the bench/bunk in his cell. "Come to gloat?" "As a matter of fact, no," Kozue replied. "I came to let you know that they'll probably let you out of here tomorrow." Gald looked up, meeting her eyes, his expression quizzical. "How do you figure?" he said. "Callie's data pretty conclusively proves that the YF-21's control system was unsafe. General Z's not even going to recommend a court-martial. They're just letting you cool your heels in here till they can get a qualified neuropsych on planet to check you out in the morning." She shrugged. "I figured it might help you sleep." Gald grunted. "Surprised you give a damn." "Yeah, so am I," Kozue admitted, which made him give her a startled glance. "I mean, I don't know why I ought to. It's not like you weren't a grade-A jerkwad to me before you had a flaky computer system messing with your brain. But what happened today wasn't your fault. And I know what it's like to have a day like that. Nobody deserves to be left hanging after an experience like that. Not even you." She folded her arms, leaning against the frame of his cell's force door. "Besides, I've got a soft spot for congenital assholes." Gald actually laughed at that. Then he got up and limped to the door, standing and regarding her through the faint blue haze of the force field. For a second, she thought he was going to come out with some hard-ass bullshit like, "I still don't like you," or some such. But instead, he gazed silently at her for a moment and then shocked her right to the core by coming to attention and saluting her. "Whatever else happened today, Kaworu," he said gravely, "I'm aware that you probably saved my ass, and maybe even my career. I won't forget that." Then he turned away, limped back to his bunk, sat down, and said, "Now get out of my face. I have a lot of thinking to do." Kozue gazed at him for a moment, then smiled slightly. "Yeah," she said, "I bet you do. See you around, space caveman." Kozue walked into Pancho's just as a band started playing "I Think I Like It." She had just enough time to think, "Wow, they sound just like the Art of Noise," before she looked up at the stage and saw that they were the Art of Noise. "Surprise!" Starbuck declared, hooking an arm around her neck and supplying her with a beer in more or less the same movement. "Look who I found!"
"Excuse me?" Boomer interjected. "Who found?"
"Well, okay, it was kind of a team effort," Starbuck allowed. Up on stage, Kosway's brother Miki spotted her at the back and grinned, too busy wielding his blue and white Rickenbacker to give her any other sign. The pilots of Rogue Squadron and the 17th, the Rogue's tech crew and the YF-19 team, Isamu Dyson and the Sterlings, some of the exhibitors, even Death Star Tarkin, surrounded her at the bar, toasting her as the heroine of the hour.
"You know, since about 1950, people have been asking me, Gordo, now, who's the best pilot you ever saw?" Cooper observed. Then he grinned, raised his beer, and said as his fellow pilots hooted and elbowed each other, "I'm looking at her." Kozue didn't really believe him. She figured he was just being nice to the new kid, putting on the charm. But she'd take it anyway. She grinned back and clinked her mug against his. "Flattery will get you anywhere, hot dog," she said, and the party rolled on all night long. This concludes Rogue Squadron No. 5, Crucible.